And we know the challenges of Friday, honourable members. The purpose of this meeting really is an empowerment session. You'll be aware that our public hearing starts on Monday, on Tuesday. And I do know that honourable members don't like to appear unprepared in the public. So this is but another attempt to empower us. I know we've received very, very many inputs, and we've asked both the research team and the legal team to give us an overview of what has transpired so far, and to highlight for us what the issues are so that we can go and prepare. Because remember, honourable members, this is our hearing. It's us that have to either reject or accept. It's really not theirs. Their participation ends today. Today their participation ends. So we need to ask as many questions as possible if we need to. So there will be an overview from the content advisor. And then we will take questions. Kolisi, 15 minutes as you always know. And then we will get our legal team colleagues to do the same. And then we will seek questions of clarity. And then there's the public program adoption. Maybe we should do it the other way and do the adoption first and then do the others, because we are all here. But the program, honorable members, you would have, all of you, I think, under folder number 6 or 9. Is it 6? Yeah. Under number 6, you'd have the program, honorable members. It really just means that we start on the 6th of March, which is Tuesday, and it's off-site because there's no venues. It's walking distance from here. Is it not walking distance from here? St. George's Mall. I thought St. George's Mall is walking distance. It's too far. No, it's not too far, man. No. Hold on. St. George's Mall, I thought it's around the corner here. All right, okay, no, fine. Then I was thinking of this St. George's Mall here. All right, no, I'm told it's not walking distance, so Cindy will either talk to us about the transport arrangements and or parking arrangements, because other people could go directly. Okay. Leaving here at 8:30, but she'll arrange for parking for members that go straight there. If you could do that, Cindy. So that is what's going to happen, honourable members, on the 6th until 1 o'clock. On the 7th, at the same venue, we do that, and we do it also until round about 1 o'clock. And then we do it on Friday, all three, at the same venue. Oh, Friday is here. Yeah. Friday is here, and it's normal business. So those would be the hearings, public hearings. You'll note, honourable members, that on all days we finish before lunch. So because we are a poor committee, we're not organising lunch for you there. You'll probably be back for lunch. So your lunch would be as per normal, and we're going to the house. So we'll organise water for you when we're there, but we're not going to organise lunch for you. That's the programme, really. We've taken a decision to invite everybody who has not indicated that he's unwilling to come. So if there were 35 submissions, there's 35 invitees, except those that specifically said we don't want to be here. That's the first decision that you need to take, because ordinarily members go through the submissions and say, you know what, we're only going to see 2 or 3, the rest don't make sense. But we took the stance that everybody who's made time and effort should be afforded an opportunity to come and talk to us, except those that have said they don't want to come and talk to us. So that's the first decision. The second decision is the logistics. that we're going off-site because we have not got a suitable venue inside, and that permission has been granted. All we'll do is organize transport for those that need transport from here, and for those that go directly, we will organize parking. And I would imagine Cindy will give us the exact physical address for some of us, because St. George's Mall, some of us would have come here. All right, if you can give that to us. That's the program, honorable members. Comments on the program, or adoption, or otherwise. Honorable Singh.
No, Chair, that's fine. Will we get breakfast at Fountains? Bachelors, we don't eat at home.
Anybody else? Adoption? Thank you very much, honorable members. So that is it. From Tuesday, we work from the Fountains. And you're saying it's the foreshore somewhere. Somebody somewhere to say.
WhatsApp.
You'll WhatsApp it to us. Yeah. Because some of us you won't see until Tuesday. All right. Okay. That then deals with the last agenda item, honorable members, and that has been duly adopted. So we'll go ahead and make the necessary arrangements both for participants and for members of this committee, and I would imagine everybody else that is going to be there. Thank you very much. Apologies, Cindy.
We received apologies from Ms. Kuno, Mr. Mpanza, Ms. Lavini Dubazana, and Mr. McLaughlin.
Happiness with apologies? Yep. Thank you very much. As I said, honorable members, there's no decisions taken here except for the program. The rest was for empowerment. So those that aren't here will have to be empowered by us privately. Thank you very much, honorable members. Cindy's insisting that we do committee meetings of the 7th. We can't because we don't have a quorum. So that will stand over until we do. Can we then immediately go into the content advisor's input? And we will ask you to stop at 5:30.
Tenure Chair, good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. Mine will be very short, Chair. What I've just done, as you recall, on the 24th of November 2017, last year, our committee, the SCOAC, resolved to publish the bill for public comments. Indeed, that happened on the 19th of January, and the due date was initially made to be 19th of February, which was later extended to the 23rd of January of February. After the cutoff date, the committee received 35 public comments from all occupations, including civil society organizations, professional bodies, individuals, both provincial and local government spheres. They made unique and critical comments with regard to the bill. But the comments were ranging from legal key issues of a policy nature that will need a committee decision, and also some cosmetics such as grammar and also spellings. What I've done is that I just extracted and elucidated some few key issues which I name that of a policy nature that will need a committee decision later. Then the legal will take all the key issues which were very numerous that emanating from the submitters. One of the key issues that I've extracted and elucidated was the issue of a revenue fund. If you look close, 3B1BE of the bill requires the Auditor General to deposit money received from the debtors to the National Revenue Fund or Provincial Revenue Fund, as the case may be. The majority of submitters, they have raised a concern about with this clause. In particular, the concern around whether it is appropriate, whether the deposition of the money to the National Revenue Fund or Provincial Revenue Fund, is it appropriate if one considers the fact that what about if the debtor that suffered a loss is a self-funded, doesn't get money from the fiscals, or the debt is governed by the Municipal Finance Management Act. So they will say, why do you think that, why the bill makes this provision, I mean this provision, that the money that collected by the age will be deposited to the National Professional Revenue Fund? What about if the debtor that suffers a loss is a self-sufficient, it's a self-funded entity? How is going to, in a nutshell, how is going to get the money back to the, deposit to its bank account? If you deposit the money to the National Revenue, Professional Revenue Fund, how this money, if a debtor that suffers a loss is a self-funded entity, how is going to get the money back to its account? That's the first concern that they raise. And the second concern issue was about the absence or lack of mediation on the aggrieved debtor. You recall that clause 3B1BG provides they provide that the debtor who is aggrieved by the decision of the AG to recover the money to approach the High Court. So they argue that, it is unfair to the debtor because the only recourse after it has been issued with the certificate is to approach the High Court, considering the cost of that particular of such action towards the debtor. So why the bill is not providing a certain resolution, disputes such as mediation? Before the debtor can go and approach the court, why don't you have a mediation, a resolution dispute mediation, arbitration, so that the debtor, so that the aggrieved debtor can meet or try to resolve that disagreement between the AG and that particular aggrieved debtor? That's the second issue that they've raised. The third issue that they raised was the issue of a recovery of debts by the AG. As you recall, Clause 3B1BA empowers AG to recover from the responsible accounting officer or authority, as the case may be, any loss suffered, any loss as a result of unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure, as defined by the legislation of the relevant auditors. Then, I think the argument here is that there is the concern that if you add this function, the debt collection function, to the AG, the concern whether it's not going to undermine the primary role of the AG, being that of an independent auditor, thereby compromising its constitutional independence. They further argue that, for example, if the AG now is a debt, is going to recover debt, then and that debt has to pay to the National Revenue Fund. That would mean that the AG must account to the relevant provincial treasury, to the relevant treasury, whether in the form of national, if the money that was collected and deposited to the National Revenue Fund, then you have to account the national treasury. If the money was recovered and deposited in the provincial revenue fund, it means you must be accounting to the provincial treasury. So they said, no, it means that if the AG does that, so that would also compromise also its constitutional independence, because that would be a conflict of its constitutional independence, because you find the AG that's going to account on the accuracy of the money collected and deposited in the relevant revenue fund. So they say this, at the end of the day, might have a potential of conflict of undermining or compromising the AG's in constitutional independence. And secondly, on the same issue of recovery of debt, they say that according to their understanding is that the recovery currently is a function of a concerned institution as provided by different legislation. For example, PFMA, Section 34 of the PFMA provides the recovery of the unlawful, fruitless, irregular expenditure, and also Section 32 of the FMMA, if you read with the Section 96 of the Municipal Systems Act, also provides the debt recovery of this particular expenditure. And in particular, there's a regulation called Municipal Regulation on Financial Misconduct Procedures and Criminal Proceedings, which also provide how these expenditures should be recovered. They did not only provide, it also put some measures and also structures in place in the form of committees on how these particular committees can interact in order to recover this particular debt. So they are worried that if now you have got this a function, how this function of the old age will be applied in view of the current legislation, of the existing legislation, which also aiming at the recovery of the debt. So they need a clarity how this age will, the function of collection of debt will be applied in view of the current existing legislation. And also one of the issue, the fourth issue was emanating from clause 32PA, which provides this one, you know that this new bill will seek to provide the aging and said able to establish a remuneration committee, which one of the functions of the remuneration committee will make a recommendation to the independent commission on service and allowance and benefit of the AG, which the function previous in the previous PAA was a function value to be done by this COAG. So they said no, they raised a concern because they said, if you give this power to AG to establish that remuneration committee, which the remuneration committee in turn will determine his or her salary, to the independent commission, will not be construed as a conflict of interest. That is the concern that there is. Also, the last one was also emanating from clause 91B, which empowers again DAG to appoint the audit committee. We recall that the primary function and purpose of the audit committee is to provide an oversight of financial management, risk and performance. That normally comes to here in the committee and provide. So now, also, if you consider the fact that the AG is an accounting office of the office of the AG. So now, if the AG appoints the members of the AC, that are going to oversee her in the end. So it's not going to be compromising the independence of the audit committee itself. So, Chairperson, in conclusion, I think in future, I know that maybe after we engage and with the after the public hearings, after some items or issues that have been raised, have been clarified more after that engagement, I think we have to conclude on the following: whether it is appropriate to recover losses of monies to the next, whether the recovered monies should be deposited to the National Provincial Revenue Fund. Secondly, whether creating a mediation process, for the debtor between the debtor and AGG before the debtor approaches the High Court is permissible. And also whether or not to recover or collect of the collection of debtor by AGG will not compromise its constitutional independence. I think this is the one thing that features mostly here. And fourthly, whether or not the establishment of remuneration committee will by the DAG will not be a cause of conflict of interest. And lastly, whether or not the appointment of audit committee by DAG will not compromise the independence of the AC. So these are the few key issues that extracted and elucidated that I am saying that at the end of the because they are the key. There are the issues that will need a committee to decide. That's why we normally term them as the policy issues because they are not legally. Sometimes they don't need legal answers rather than the discussion and debate and an agreement by the committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
And Gospute, just one comment before we open it up. And this is mine. Maybe members will have a different view. You know, I've always understood your role to be one that advises us. So it's one thing to say South Africans are saying we've got a problem with X, but you should be coming and saying that I think you guys should be saying Y to that X. Just my criticism, so that we are able to debate it here. Unless you feel that you're humble, you want to leave them to do it, it's fine. But normally here it's a caucus session where you come as the expert and say, you know what, on this one, buy a bet. Or on this one, we agree with them or whatever the case might be. But that's fine. Honourable members, can we then just go, but thank you very much, it helps us. Can we then go point by point, and if there are any comments to Goli, we deal with them and then move to the next one. Or if we're going to just discuss them amongst ourselves and then we move to the next one. In that fashion, we will then cover all these. And if there are blind spots that you've identified, we can always give it to him and he can go and help us to develop those if there are. So could we go to point number one about the revenue fund? Presentations are under number 5. Those are the three, that's scholarly presentation included, and legal. Under number 5 you have them. Any comments around the revenue fund, 30B1BE? And Cole, if you want to comment later on, we'll afford you to comment on those. Anything, Honorable Singh?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation, because at least to bring some focus into the issues, unless there are other issues that legal has picked up, which we'll hear about later. But I think that's a reasonable argument that, you know, if money has been lost by, let's say, Department of Water Affairs, somebody has pocketed, somebody has unfairly gained R1 million or something through a contract, and then the Auditor General picks that up, then that money should actually go back to that department, probably via Treasury. But it brings into question, the office of the AG is going to be doing a lot of work to recover that money. What do they get out of it? There's got to be something as well for the AG. And yesterday, I just at the top of my head spoke about this retainer thing, you know, where maybe government has got to consider giving the office of the AG a certain amount, a kind of a, what we call it in legal terms, a lawyer will get a retainer for the kind of work that they are doing. When we say so many million, 100 million or whatever it can be appropriated there to the AG, so that at least they will be compensated for these kinds of activities that they will be involved in. But it makes sense that the money can't go to the office of the AG, because it's not the AG's, that office's money, if it's recovered, you know, through a department having been defrauded. So I think we'll just have to apply our mind, what are we going to put in place so that the AG's office is not prejudiced in any way as well, and that the benefit only goes to the receiving department.
Other comments on that one? None? Let me put my comment. Mine is slightly different. You know, Honorable Members, my view is, if I argue against what you're saying, Honorable Singh, Department A lost money through maladministration. Doesn't matter who. They've lost money through maladministration. The AG picks it up. If that AG takes that money and gives it back to this defaulting department, what are the consequences? Because had the AG not picked it up, they would have lost that money. So, I mean, if the AG is going to pick it up and give it back to Department A, I'm trying to understand, you know, if you don't feel the pain, you're not going to change your behavior. That's just one thing that I'm looking at. I'm talking about from this thing that you call self-funded or the department. But my understanding is that this money is not going to go to the AG. It's going to go to the revenue fund. It's going to go back into the pot, into the fiscus. Then Treasury must decide, because clearly, why would you continue to give money to Carter if Carter consistently abuses the money? Treasury will then take a decision and say Carter doesn't deserve it. Although Carter's services might be critical, she doesn't deserve it. Give it to Singh. I'm just talking about consequences, because we continue talking about consequence management. I don't see the consequences if the AG picks it up and gives it back to the defaulting person. That's just my view. Now you'd have to, and other people would have to convince me differently. Because then all the AG is doing is being the defender of a department. Money gets lost, gives it back to him. I would say go to revenue fund, and certainly the powers that be must then take a decision whether Carter is worthy of that money. I mean, there could be conditions put to giving the money back to the department. We'll give it back to the department on condition that accounting officer Carter is no longer in charge of it. Why would you continue to give it back to a defaulter? That's just my view on the matter. But I'm saying these are our views, and this is the essence of public hearing, that people must convince us otherwise. I just don't think that makes sense on that one. But Cody, you can defend or defeat us at the end of the day when you do it. We're just giving you views, and no, you'll come back to them, we'll give you 5. Other members can give their views if they want to. On that one, I just think that, I personally think that there's nothing wrong with this, but if South Africans feel otherwise, we'll be guided by them. Any other comment on that, on the revenue fund matter? Otherwise, we'll move to the second one. Honorable Carter, Remember, these are just views that we're putting to help each other when we go and formulate our questions and our positions for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. Yeah. Carter, Honorable.
Chair, I also share your view. Again, I think that maybe what we should do is also get an input from Treasury, just on the matter, how they see how we should deal with it.
At some point, Treasury will come and see us. But I'm saying by the time it comes to Treasury, we should have been able to go back to Treasury and say, this is the overwhelming position of South Africans, and Treasury will defend it. But Treasury do have a slot to come to us at some point. Let's go to the second one. South Africans, those that think that here, grieve that we are saying that if you are found to be in default, and you don't agree with the AG, go to the High Court. And they are saying, but that's why must you go to the High Court? Why can't we get a mediator? That's in essence what they are saying. Any views from members of the side? Let me start. Oh no, let's start with Juba.
And my apologies for having arrived late. Chairperson, one is sympathetic to the view of the mediator, but the question that arises, it's the weight behind mediation versus the High Court. One asks oneself whether mediator is not seen as a feeling of saying, I mean, something that has to do with monetary value. If it has something to do with with monetary value, then it's a bit questionable. I would insist also on the High Court, depending on the integrity of what of the AG. It cannot just rest only on the financial part of it. So I think it has to do with credibility. So I would suggest that the High Court should be the route to take. Thank you.
Honorable Carter. Gee, this is, okay. When it comes to time period, I want to say the following, and I'm not saying it proudly, that we've been in courts quite a bit over the last couple of years. And for a High Court matter, okay, if it's not an urgent application, you can wait for a year and a half. So that doesn't play the game on the, you know, when we talk about time frames, because High Court matters can take extremely long. On the other side, we have to look at affordability, the cost involved of going to High Court. So I've got mixed feelings about it. On the one side, you want to say it's got to be punitive, and, you know, if anything, you've got to go to the High Court to do it. But on the other side, too, if you look at the time frames that could be involved of getting the matter resolved in the High Court or to be heard in the High Court is one issue. And the other one is the cost implications it would have.
I don't believe there's any other mediation mechanism in any other act for a similar review of any government department decision or minister's decision, etc. The only way to review any ministerial decision would probably be in a High Court in this manner. So there is no other method in law other than going to a High Court. So I think this is probably the best way for the type of thing, considering that the Auditor General has just given an opinion which would confirm in more than likely an opinion of the department that the matter was irregular, etc., and needs to be recovered. So I think they almost are the arbitrator to an extent. They become their first arbitrator, and if people really believe that they're wrong, then I think this is the best method, unless we can find another existing method in law, because mediation is, I don't think it's going to be appropriate for this.
All right, let me give my sense. You'll take note of all these things. Again, honorable members, and we don't know yet, good. It also depends who is bringing these things. Recall, we've got lots of inputs from local government, I'm using it as an example, provincial government. Obviously, these people will fight back. Obviously, they'll fight back, because in the main, they're going to be what you're calling the debtor. Because remember, it's the accounting authority in the main that's the debtor. In all these instances, in the main, it's the accounting authority that's the debtor, whether it's the DG, the board, or whatever. And they are saying, no, but why are you taking us to the High Court? It's costly. Of course I expect them to say that. But then High Court, the serious economic, whatever it is, I'm just talking about the principle of going to court, already exists. The PFMA says that if the accounting authority is whatever, you must take criminal action. Nobody has argued this thing in the PFMA. It says that it's a criminal offense which is liable to a fine or incarceration, currently. The problem is that we've not implemented the PFMA. Why has nobody come and said to us, and I don't know what the MFMA says, but certainly the PFMA says, Section 86 says you must take him to court. That's what it says. Right? Yes, criminal steps means that criminal steps can only be through court, no through mediation. So, and I'm just putting this on the table as devil's advocate. When somebody comes and says to me, let's mediate, why have they not said that? When they said that because we've not implemented Section 86 of the PFMA. And now when we're starting to show real teeth, people are realizing, and of course they're fighting back, whoever they might be. But that's going to be my argument. And remember, they must convince us otherwise for us to put pen to paper. So that would be my comment on that one. And everybody can assist us, because really we're asking you guys to help us. If what we're saying is totally off tangent, then you would need to help us. But these are our original views. Any other views on that one, or can we move on? Any other views, yes, Steve?
An additional view. If I'm looking quickly at the section, there's no real time frames other than the 180 day or later. So my understanding of this was that the Auditor General would only be doing this recovery if the accounting officer of that municipal entity or local government failed to do so. So we're talking, I mean, probably almost 2 years after the effect. So if that decision has been made, the person has the opportunity to go to court to have that decision reviewed, and I think that even be a basis for urgency in that type of circumstance. And it's not the local council that's going to be, money's going to be recovered from. It's going to be individuals that have mismanage that local council, etc. And I think that's part of the risk of accepting a position as an accounting officer of a local government or whatever the case might be. You've got to understand. You've got to make sure you comply with that, or you're going to have to defend your actions later, probably in a court of law. So I think it's probably going to fly as we've got it drafted.
I'm assuming Adil and Mariska, is it? Marissa, I'm assuming that you guys are taking notes so that you can also, in your input when you come to us, answer some of these questions, because it's really about empowering you. So when you come in and argue, and your arguments are not strong enough, they'll be shot down, and I would assume they're shooting yourself in the foot, or they will be sustained, which means it will give you power. It's really about you. So if you take notes and start a process of answering some of these questions for us to help you. You want to talk on the same point, ma'am?
I want to just ask you a question quickly. Yes. For example, you are the accounting officer. You've got all of us as staff members, but we are all politically sort of aligned, and we take decisions, you the accounting officer. And because at the end of the day, you know, you can set up people politically, specifically if you look at municipalities. Municipalities are so political at this stage. The administration is political. Everything's political. What about political assassination? I mean, we are really setting you as the accounting officer up. We've got to look at those type of things as well. It's a reality.
We'll debate them later. No, I agree with you, but I do think, honourable members, that when you accept a position, even the MP or the chair of the board or whatever, it's not a Sunday afternoon picnic. When I give you responsibility for
billions of rands as the accounting officer of, I don't know, Eskom, or billions of rand as the accounting officer of a department. Surely the risk involved would be consumerate with the potential for you to take bread off somebody else's table. I hear what you're saying, but I think that can't be something that we legislate. We can't legislate against assassinations. It's a reality of life. Some other agency or some other means must be responsible for dealing with it. But what we are saying is that if you misappropriate taxpayers' money, then pay it back or face the consequences. Simple as all that. I think that's what we're intending to do at the end of the day, because we were not able to do that up to now, because the AG's powers were purely just that of recommendations. But let's take another round if you want to. Everybody will have a chance, including if you want to talk on this matter, we'll move to the next one. Let's start with you, sir.
Yeah, but we're also going off point. The point isn't the principle that the money must be recovered. Nobody's disagreeing with that in the public submissions. So the question is whether going to the High Court is the right point or not. Bear in mind, if you go to High Court and you're still the accounting officer of the municipality is going to be funding your legal bill while you're in office. The High Court might find that you must pay those costs personally, etc. The problem is going to come with a person that's been dismissed by a political party, for instance, and then sued, that he wouldn't have access to the purse. But more than likely, there'll be somebody that's prepared to take it on a contingency basis if the argument is really good. If it's not good, then you're going to have to find the money yourself, I would presume.
Sure, thank you. You see, I think the High Court is the last resort. The four examples that colleague Chopper has spoken about, the last resort, you know, if somebody resists, etc., etc. I don't think we can legislate for a one-size-fits-all here. So I think maybe when the AG's office comes back and we all apply our minds more to this, we must look at other ways, but with the High Court being the ultimate, place where you want to recover your money. And then secondly, some of us went on a study tour to Uganda and Kenya. And I think it was in Uganda where they've already got the system in place of recovering money. In fact, they got the police sitting there when Skopa is sitting to take people away and put them in prison. So I think if you must just go back to that report and see what they're doing in Uganda and Kenya, and let's try and learn from their experience as well to see if we can learn something from them in this regard. Thank you.
Anything, Honorable Carter, to add? Suspendo? Nothing? Thank you very much. And then we would move to issue number 3 raised by Coley and his team. The Remunerations Committee is being appointed by the Accounting Authority, which is the DAG. And is it appropriate for the DAG to appoint a remuneration, the AG, I beg your pardon, that the AG must appoint the Remunerations Committee that is going to take a decision on his well-being one way or the other. Is that appropriate? Does the AG appoint the Remunerations Committee, or should it not be done by this committee? That's the point being raised by some of the submitters. Comments from members? Honorable Singh. And then Honorable Ntobela.
I think the remuneration, from my knowledge, the remuneration of the AG is determined by us. SCOAC, we make recommendations, etc. Then it goes to the president, who does the appointment and the contract. But the am I right? And then the audit, the remuneration committee has otherwise been appointed. But maybe we must consider, for the audit committee and the remuneration committee, that it must be in consultation with SCOAC. So there is this other checks and balance. I'm just saying that at the top of my head, without applying my mind seriously. But some of these things can be done in consultation with us, so it brings the parliamentary process in together with the Office of the AG. Especially with the appointment. Because I can tell you, Chair, my experience with the last Remuneration Committee, my personal experience with Dr. George and the chairman of the committee was that when we were negotiating the package for an AG, I won't say which AG, my own personal, and I mentioned it at the committee, was that I found that some of those members on that committee who were dealing with remuneration had a bias towards the individual and the AG. And I think we must try and remove that kind of thing. So if we say in consultation with us, we can look at their independence, et cetera, and then take it from there.
Carmela?
Jeremy. Thank you, Chair. I tend to agree with the
I tend to agree with the submitters here, Chair, that if the very existence of the remuneration the remuneration committee is dependent on the AG whose salary they have to determine at a certain point, it really creates a very serious conflict of interest. So I would rather prefer that it be done by the standing committee, as long as it doesn't pose any challenges regarding the legal parameters. So thank you. That's how I feel about it.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chopper?
I don't see a problem because it only makes recommendations to the independent commission. So I don't see the definition of independent commission, what that exactly is. So maybe we can get clarity on that. At this stage, the Remuneration Committee is not setting the remuneration as submitted yet. It's making a recommendation to a commission that makes the final say. So what makes up the commission is what's important to consider when we look at it.
Honourable Bender.
Thank you, Chair. I also agree with the Honourable Member, which says that there should be an independent commission. They should be working together with the SCOAC so that there should be no bias between these two, because I know that there should be maybe the interest in some of the members if there can be only the SCOAC committee, only that can deal with the salary of the AG. For instance, in the issue of the remunerations of members of parliament, which is by the independent judge, like for instance. Thank you.
All right, my two cents about this is I agree very much. First of all, somebody would need to explain to us what this independent commission really is. Unless it's explained in here and we've not looked at it, but who's and what is this independent? But I think the principle that we are talking about makes sense, that the AG's remuneration can't be determined by somebody solely appointed by him to take the decision. That's the first thing. But even if you look in the corporate world, honorable members, remuneration committees, or whatever you call them, subcommittees, are appointed by the board. Who are and those committees deal with the salaries of the executives of the committee. So they are outside of the department, outside of the company, and so on. And we're saying that's the principle that must apply here. We are one of those. When I say we, I'm talking about this committee is one of them. If the independent body is Judge Cerruti and his team or whoever it might be, that could well work. But it can't be that it is in-house that this thing is done. I think that's the principle. So when you guys come back to us, or when we go into our own homework between now and Tuesday, if there is a definition of what this independent thing is and we think that it's outside sufficiently, then it's fine. If it's not outside sufficiently, then we must reject or amend that suggestion and strengthen it as members are suggesting here. Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you again. Just another dimension is, you see, we're dealing with a Chapter 9 institution. And we must look at its independence. We must also look at it vis-a-vis, like, let's say, the Public Protector and the Human Rights Commission. What do they do within those institutions? and you know, just see, get a sense of whether we can really interfere or whether it's up to them to determine that kind of thing.
All right. We will go and do that homework. Everybody else will do that homework. And if you can whisper to us, all of you, so that we have a constructive discussion on Monday, whoever brought this up, we are able to raise it. And I'm sure they're also listening to us wherever they are, formulating their own responses to our initial thinking. So we're looking at all of you to assist us in arguing either to or, I mean, for or against it, and that we don't appear to be silly or not having applied our mind. Goli, you want to respond to any of these things? You don't have to, but you put them on the table. But if you want to respond or if you want time to assist us to sharpen our arguments, that's the case. But let's hand it back to you.
No, thank you. Apologies for not meeting the requirement that we expected. I thought that normally it's our ritual when we consider the bill that the advice comes after we engage the pub hearing. When we are considering the bill, it's where we normally give our views, say this is the advice in each and every issue that has been raised. Now it was just a summary highlighting issues that have been raised out of the submission. That was the intention of this brief, actually. But I'm sorry if that is not what was expected, but this is a ritual. We just consider a bill now, which is what the route that we have followed. Okay, before that, I think let me just, lastly again, I must say that I think that I thought that these issues were going to be engaged later on everything after we met, after the public hearings, but I think I can commend some of them. For example, in the number one of the revenue fund, I think your argument maybe is also valid, but if you consider the data that suffered a loss. I mean, if you consider the ODT that suffered a loss, if it's a self-funded organization and doesn't get the money from the fiscals, why are you going to take
back? Who's a self-funded organization?
No, I mean, even the what you call the SOEs, for example, they're also audited by old age, and then they can fund this kind of fruitless and wasteful expenditures. Like for example, and if AG was also subject to that, because you know it's also another self funded, but it's not audited by AG. So these institutions talk about. So these institutions raise their revenue. At the end of the day, you take their revenue and put it to the fiscals. Besides the department argument, I hear you and I concur with the department argument. But what about the self funded entities? And also, I think with the issue of mediation, I think. I will also put it, because the issue is about the principle here, whether the High Court is the appropriate first place to refer. To refer the aggrieved data. Why there are no other? Because even the PFM that we're talking about, it's talking about criminal. If there is a suspicion of criminal activity, then put in the relevant. Investigation, SAPC, SA, South African Police Services, South African Police Service, then investigate and do the Criminal Procedures Act, whatever, according to their own ways. So I think that's what it is featured, yes, because if I approach the High Court, the cost involved on such kind of thing, in my part of the data, it is unfair, other than if there was another avenue that I could have, I could convince the AG. With the collector, that's the age in this regard, with the mother that I'm owing. Lastly, Chair, with regard to this of salary and benefit, one of the things is correct. Before, it was the committee according to PAA, the PAA that we are amending now. It was that was done, even the current age, that was done by the current, by the SCOWEC, that determined the salary and benefit of the current age. But I think there was an act that was... the act that was created by the what called the Department of Justice, where it ended up saying that all the chapter 9 institution have been, the remission of the chapter 9 institution be conducted by this independent commission. So they did repeal the very section that we have in the PAA where it was requiring the committee to determine the salary and benefits of the AG. Now it's determined by that independent commission which was created by this act, which I'm forgetting now, it's just passed last year. So now the salary of all chapter 9 institutions are determined by that particular commission, independent commission. In this instance, now they're saying that the remuneration committee was established by the AG have to make a recommendation. I don't know whether the argument could be the scholar could make a recommendation or the remuneration committee. But in my previous understanding, my previous experience was that even scholar sometimes was getting some capacity problem, and we even outsource another person who still required Alexander Forbes in order. The actuaries in order to determine the salary of the AG, of the intern AG by that time. So I'm not sure whether the remuneration committee will be relevant or the scholars will be relevant in this regard. I think these are the only comments. And other comments, as I say, that our view, in my view as a conduct advisor, the advice, I thought I was going to come with them after we have engaged. And in fact, after them, the submitters have made their side clear and they clarify the questions. The other side of their submissions. So that was the purpose and the aim of this presentation.
Thank you very much. I think the last point that you were making, if there's a law that says there's an independent body that looks at it outside of the AG, I think it's the principle that we're talking about. That helps us clarify the point. But let's just raise the first, I'll come back to you, Chief. Let's raise the point that you were raising early on. You know, honorable members, I I'm talking for myself, I don't see public hearings as a malicious compliance that we must just listen to people coming because they've come. If there's somebody that comes and puts a point that at that point we feel, but this thing doesn't make sense, surely we should be able to say to Mr. Ntombela, but Mr. Ntombela, lento yako doesn't make sense to us. Now, that is why we were asking you, Goli. I think we're talking the same language. You are empowering us to ask hard questions of these people that gave it to us. And after their questions, you'll still have another time to say, but having listened to them, we are not convinced because this is the position. But I just don't think we should go there just to listen to people. And I'm saying this to members. They must know when they come here that they are not coming here on a holiday. So those that have Cindy said that they want to come here, I'm hoping they're listening to us so that they change their mind if they thought they were coming here just to regurgitate what they've put in writing and we're just going to say thank you very much. I'm certainly not going to say thank you very much. Those that come with something that makes no sense, we must say to them, but this thing doesn't make sense, Chief. And that is why we were asking you to help us to sharpen that type of thing. But and you'll have a second bite later on. When I say you, I'm saying all of us will have a second bite later on. So I just thought, as our planning, honorable members, that you don't think that we're just going to listen to them. Otherwise, we don't need to call them. There will be no purpose of bringing them here. When they come here, he must defend his argument. And he can only defend his argument if we are sharp. All right. Did you want to say something on this one before we move to legal? Thanks, Mr. Topham.
Sorry, two things. On the last thing said, I think it's important then that we do add a definition into the Amendment Act of an independent commission, which would be set up. Is it there? That hasn't been put in yet, okay? So fine. It either refers to existing commission or we can even add in some should that commission fall away, comes to the Sky Committee or something like that to approve. And then, sorry, on point three, there was a second point about audit committees, which I think actually does make sense. The Deputy AG is the accounting officer. The current Act says the Deputy AG appoints the audit committee in consultation with the AG. Now, obviously, we all know that in consultation is a pain, and nobody understands what it is. So I can understand that the intention is to make it easier and clear for the person to appoint. But then I'm actually thinking that that shouldn't be the deputy. It should actually be the Auditor General that appoints the members of the Auditor Committee, not the Deputy Auditor General type of thing.
All right. Those are initial shots. We will argue them with those that come and argue otherwise, or wherever you picked it up from those people, they must pick it up. But it's helping us. Let's take another round on the basis of this, because remember, we're not finalizing. We're sharpening it. Ntombela, Singh, Carter, Bengu and Adams, if you want to have anything to say, just broadly, then we're going to move on to the next.
Thank you, Chair. I only needed some clarity on the funding of the SOEs. Lolly is saying they are partly funded, so it means sourcing their fund from somewhere else other than the government. And my understanding was that an SOE is there on it's there on behalf of the government. It does its business on behalf of government. At the end of the day, it has to deliver service on behalf of the government. So I find nothing wrong in the AG having to do what it is expected of him to do with regard to the accounting purposes of SOEs. I wanted some clarity there, because it's like they have another arm that is a bit independent from government, so they can just do as they please, if I understood him very well. Can I get some clarity there, please?
Yeah, Chair, departments audit committees are appointed by the DG.
Yeah,
by the DG. So let's have some consistency as we apply our minds on this. Because the DG here is not the AG. The accounting officer is the DAG. So let's just think about that as well.
We're not talking about the audit committee. We're talking about the remunerations committee, isn't it? We're talking about both of them. Oh, okay. All right. Carter, if there's anything from your side?
Chair, mine is just really a request to, if on all the submissions, in line with what you were saying as well, that our advisors can maybe give us what they think on just on all the submissions and maybe submit it to us by, say, Monday afternoon. Just some crucial points. What is the viewpoint to sharpen us?
Honourable Bengu? Honourable Adams? You're covered, thank you. You want to have the last bite. Yes, Chief, stop it.
So on that last matter, I'm not exactly sure if the DG is appointed in the department, but I know in a city council, for instance, council appoints your audit committee. You wouldn't have your executive appointing your audit committee. So the principle, if it is going to be applied, would be better to stop the DGs, if they are doing it at the moment, from doing it and let the minister or somebody else to appoint a AG. So you don't. The point is, the accounting officer has been audited, therefore his audit committee should be independent of him. That's the principle we should try and find.
All right. I think the point that Honourable Singh is making is that we must be consistent. And we can go, if you can do that for us, Goli, exactly how our audit committee is appointed and who takes the final decision. And if indeed it's been taken by the DG, it's not our responsibility, but we should be highlighting it. If we think that it's maybe too close and there's conflict, it can be a byproduct of this thing that we take to whoever looks at the PFMA or wherever this legislation is housed. But if you could just follow up in terms of currently who appoints audit committees of companies, I mean of departments. And then, of course, the one of Honorable Ntombela, I don't know if you want to respond to it, but we all take his point that they are not an end in themselves. State-owned entities are a means towards an end, which is government-related. And in fact, we're moving, Honourable Singh will tell you, no, not Honourable Singh, we are saying that the AG must empower himself to do more and more audits on state-owned entities to further bring them into the tent, so to say. So, yeah, the self-funded thing of, because SOEs are self-funded, they must get some leeway. I personally don't agree with that. I agree with you, but I don't see why they should be given special treatment. That then deals with Goli. I'm hoping that you've all got his numbers. As members read Goli, they might phone you for clarity independently so that you can help them or amongst each other, because at the end of the day, on Monday, we're a team, honorable members. It's us as a team trying to interrogate whoever they are. And there are quite a few high or hard hitters. I mean, the Erba, Saika, Accountability Now, it's clearly these are people that have done their homework. even that young man there is sitting here to prepare himself even for us. Where do you come from?
Myself, yeah? I'm from PMG.
No, I mistaken you. I thought you were, there was somebody else from, I think it is, what is that organization that Richard Kellen belongs to? Yes, so these guys are there, they're also preparing. What I'm saying to you, it's not going to be a picnic. It's not going to be a picnic. There are many that are for this, but there are many that think that we are being a nuisance. Many that think that it's not necessary to do this thing. I'm convinced that it's necessary. Others think that it's not necessary and they'll fight us against. Even members of parliament, I would imagine, would turn around and say, but what do you guys think you're doing? So, it's honey makkelijk is nie. For those of you that understand Afrikaans, it's going to be very difficult, Honorable Bengu, understand that people will want to push back against these things. Koli, thank you very much. We will continue to consult with you in preparation for this. In fact, I think what we should do, Honorable Members, is Cindy, you might have to give us 10 minutes, either before each day or at the end of each day, just to do an evaluation of that day's work. Either just before or afterwards that we can evaluate and gym for the next day. Fatima and your team. It is 10 o'clock. At the end of the day, by 11:30, we should be done with this thing. So can we, because I see yours is a bit longer, can we at most give you half an hour till 10:30 to do your presentation? And then, Honourable Members, we have 10:30 until 11:30 at the absolute latest to engage it. Is that okay? All right. It's 10:05, 25 to 11, we'll ask you to stop. And, Honourable Members, you do have the presentations? Thank you. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Chair, the format of our presentation, what we've done just to make things easier, that we split it into three parts. Part one is a summary of matters related to specifically the referral for investigation and the recovery of losses. I think this is the heart of the bill. Part B is matters related to other aspects in the draft bill, so your remuneration committees and all the other comments about international audits and so on. And then part C is matters that are not covered in the draft bill at all but that have been raised. And what we've done is on each of those parts, we identify particular issues with a problem statement, and then in true lawyer style, where the statement is A, I then also alert you to the fact, but what about B and C and D and E? But the purpose is to facilitate your interaction with submitters so that you're able to properly interrogate the proposal. So you will see there are a lot of questions. A lot of it we have our views and our answers to, but we wouldn't want to cloud your judgment. So we play devil's advocate and give you both sides. Starting with part A, the matters relating to the issue of referral for investigation and the recovery of losses. The main issue, and it crops up in a number of submissions, is whether the function and power relating to this referral now of undesirable audit outcomes and the consequent recovery of losses exceeds the constitutional mandate of the AG. Members will be familiar with Section 188. 188, as it currently stands, doesn't deal with the issue of investigations, nor does it deal with the issue of this recovery of losses. However, Subsection 4 does indeed say that the Auditor General has the additional powers and functions prescribed by national legislation. So in pondering this, I think the first question that we need to ask is whether these additional powers and functions that we're now purporting to put in the bill, if they can be deemed to be part of the auditing regime, or does it go so far beyond auditing that it could never have been the intention for the AG to have these powers? Because I think that, of course, subsection 4, when it says additional powers and functions, there would have to be a rational connection to the duty to audit. So that's the first thing to think about. There are many international examples of other supreme audit institutions who have investigative and or recovery powers or a combination of them. I know that the AG's office has done quite a comprehensive benchmarking exercise, and I understand that that document was distributed a few months ago to committee members where they go through the different international examples. But I will ask Marissa to resend to Cindy for circulation again. However, the committee has used the example of Ghana as our benchmark in a sense, but I just wanted to distinguish Ghana from ourselves in two respects. One, the Ghanaian constitution itself provides for the power to surcharge and disallow. And secondly, notwithstanding that power, the AG does not have the power to actually do the recovery. So just to bear that in mind. Then we've got comment that many auditors are registered with the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, and these extended powers may be in contravention of the accepted auditing standards, and the argument there is it falls outside of the audit realm. So we would want to question them on what those particular standards are that we would now be in contravention of if we did this, and if there's any way to work around it. Of course, those standards don't have the status of law. Then lastly, Chair, the Constitutional Court in the Nkandla case, the Chief Justice was at pains there in relation to the public protector to explain and eventually rule that it would be no point for these institutions to have duties, but nothing comes out of those findings, that people are not actually held accountable. And in that case, the court said that the remedial powers of the public protector are indeed binding. So there is case law on the importance of these Chapter 9 institutions and that they shouldn't be bulldogs without teeth, if I can put it that way. What is interesting to note, however, is that the Chief Justice, Mogoeng Mogoeng, did indeed do a speech to the AG's office for a symposium that they held, in which he reiterates this in relation particular to the AG, but on our reading of the content of that speech, that the Chief Justice seemed to be of the view that it would necessitate a constitutional amendment rather than legislation. But of course, there's no standing in law of those comments, but it's something that I think that we must think about. At present, I think I'm confident that it's constitutional, but of course we will wait for the submissions and see if they can convince us otherwise. On issue two, the independence of the AG will be compromised because AG will now become accountable to National Treasury in the respect of recovered funds, and there's also an added responsibility now to account to Parliament for those funds that have been recovered. Here, Chair, I think it's important for National Treasury to advise us why it's not sufficient for the AG to account for those recovered funds to Parliament. Why is it necessary for them to report to National Treasury on those funds? And then also, Chair, and this is a technical issue, but what the accounting implications would be if the AG does deposit into the National or Provincial Revenue Fund. And how will the transfer, once it's made, be accounted for? Will it be considered revenue? Because there you may possibly have a conflict insofar as the AG then goes to audit the books. And as part of that auditing exercise, the AG would see what's come in and what's left and so on. So that's a point to consider that National Treasury can give us more clarity on. And then the issue of the AG accounting to Parliament, I think there's no problem with the AG accounting to Parliament per se, because already constitutionally the AG must account to Parliament. The question that I do have is whether, and this was my own, is whether the AG would have to account to Parliament on why he failed to issue a certificate, because currently the bill is drafted to say the AG may issue a certificate, and whether this will have an impact on the AG's independence to determine when the issuing of a certificate is worth pursuing. Because, of course, it would be practically impossible to issue a certificate in every case. So to consider whether there's a risk of political interference here, with the AG being put under pressure to issue certificates or not issue certificates, whether the term may is the appropriate term, whether it should be must. Those are things that I think we need to iron out. On issue three, Many of the submitters found that the link between the investigations and the issuing of a certificate is unclear, whether the latter is dependent on the former, and if so, what the role of the investigating body would be vis-a-vis the AG, and also what does an appropriate body mean, because we said that the AG can refer to an appropriate body for investigation. As members will be aware, other organs of state, so your SIU, HORC, SAPS, are also tasked with investigation and in certain cases the recovery of misappropriated funds. And is it envisaged that these processes are going to run parallel? And what is the effect of multiple competing claims, as it were? And then if the intention of the AG is to cooperate with these other institutions, what guarantee is that these bodies will cooperate with the AG? And what happens if they refuse to sign MOUs in this regard, because nothing in their legislation would compel them to do so? Also, an appropriate body could conceivably include a private body, and the question that was raised was, should it be limited to public bodies only? So can we actually place reliance on private bodies that the AG would then have control as to who he refers to investigation for? So that also came out quite strongly. Then what happens if a referral is rejected or delayed due to a lack of capacity or funds or any other reasons? In some cases, you need proclamation by the president to allow for investigation. So what happens there if there's an undue delay or political refusal or whatever the case may be? The question is, why are we creating dependencies on these other organs? Should we not allow the AG to do this himself? And then again, the last point we have raised earlier is this issue of the election to refer the undesirable audit outcome and whether it should be mandatory, because this discretion may be seen as impacting the impartiality of the AG. On issue four, many submitters raised the question of why the bill made provision for recovery from the accounting officer or the accounting authority and not from officials who in many, or dare I say most cases, are the actual cause of the loss. They felt that blame is being heaped on the AO, and they also wanted to know why the definition of data included previous occupants of the post, because we had said that the AG can also act against previous accounting officers if it was that accounting officer who failed to recover. The intention is that the issuing of a certificate is a final attempt to recover loss. So by its nature, it is an extreme remedy. My view is that the AO still remains responsible for attempting to recover loss prior to this as provided for in law. So this is meant to deal with a situation where, as you said earlier, the AO has not done what he is supposed to be doing. It wasn't meant, the intention was not that we bypass officials and not hold officials responsible. It was rather to say the AO's job is to hold officials responsible. And if the AO has failed in that duty, that's when the AG will step in. But perhaps the bill requires more clarity in this regard. And then also, my question is, can the AG be expected during the course of an audit to always identify the source of the loss? So who is the official that caused the loss to the institution? My understanding is that the role of the AG is merely to identify the loss, to say there is irregular expenditure or there's fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And it's the role of the accounting officer, in turn, to determine what the cause is or who is the cause. And that's why the PFMA and the financial management legislation then allows for him to do, or him or her to do, an investigation to try and uncover that. But surely it cannot be the AG's role to do that. Would the AG have the capacity, the expertise, the access to officials? We would need to think of the time constraints and so on in expecting the AG to actually go into a department and find out who is the cause of the loss. Then there was a comment that the bill will have the effect of dissuading people from taking up the position of an AO because they will become guarantors of trading risks. Our view, Veche, is that the responsibility to implement sound financial management practices and systems already exists and must be honored regardless of this bill. So, in fact, in law, it is already there. To say that they're now going to become guarantors of the risk, I think is stretching the argument a little bit. But it is something that that the committee can consider and deliberate on further. Issue 5, what are the practical and procedural steps to be followed in issuing a certificate? These are not clear, so time frames and the steps to be followed, communication, etc. We largely left that to regulations because they are quite procedural in nature and you wouldn't want to clutter the bill with all of that information, but nonetheless, the points to think about here are who quantifies the loss and how. There won't always be a loss. You can have irregular expenditure where proper people have an authorized procurement, but there isn't a loss suffered at all because the department still receives value for money. In a fruitless and wasteful example, sometimes it's easy to quantify loss, sometimes it isn't that easy. So whose responsibility will it be to actually quantify what's been lost in order to determine what can now be recovered and claimed from the AO. There's no time frame for recovery of losses in financial management law. So while the duty does exist in law for the AO to take steps to recover, it doesn't say that the AO must take those steps within 100 days of uncovering this or not. I think that the issue of reasonableness comes in there. The AG has indicated that their intention would not be to act in year one or even in year two. It would be to act in year three most likely. And they, in that case, there would be more than sufficient time. The AG, as I understand it, is not expecting that those processes are necessarily concluded, but at least the AO must be able to show that they've taken positive steps on the, and they're well on the way to identifying who caused the loss and to recovering that loss. Then people talk quite strongly about this issue of the AG being burdened with additional task of debt collecting, especially in light of the fact that there are debt collecting capabilities within departments themselves, state attorney and so on, and felt that this may possibly detract from the AG's core functions because the resources, both money and people-wise, are going to be pumped into this where it could be better spent elsewhere. And another issue that is raised is what is the status of internal audits? So those are audits that departments do themselves. And why is there no provision made to place reliance on these audits? And the AG can perhaps just explain to us to what extent they do place reliance on internal audits when they do their auditing function. Issue 6 is existing legislation, and in particular MFMA and PFMA, not sufficient to prevent the mischief that the bill seeks to address. So recovery processes are contained in financial legislation. The question is, are these sufficient? So I think we need to go back and look at what the mischief is that the bill is trying to address. By way of example, the AO commits an act of financial misconduct if in breach of the PFMA. So is this alone not sufficient to act against a defaulting AO that fails to recover? And why are AOs not being acted against if legislation is indeed clear enough? So are we over-legislating? Is it a case that the sword is there, but the sword is blunt? Or does the AG indeed have a role to play? So that's an issue that we have discussed before, but maybe we can interrogate further. Then where does the recovery process fit in relation to these financial management processes and recovery processes provided for in law? Is it not duplication of roles? That came through quite strongly. Our view and our understanding is that the one happens in the absence of the other. It was never meant to happen concurrently. It was only where the AO does not act or fails to act or fails to act appropriately. And then lastly, should financial legislation rather provide for consequent and clearer action? So should it be the PFMA and MFMA that's amended instead of giving this power to the AG? Issue 7. The definition of undesirable audit outcome has been questioned, in particular whether it should include material non-compliance with laws rather than speaking only to financial loss. And many commenters felt that the definition is wide and vague. So the first point there is whether environmental non-compliance can actually be quantified. So often my understanding is that the AG may make a finding that a department's processes aren't proper and that they need new systems in place to deal with certain risks. And people are saying, why are we not acting against that and only dealing with actual pecuniary losses? But the difficulty there is a practical one. What would a certificate then contain if not a reference to a monetary debt? Because then it would appear that all your certificate would be saying is that the accounting officer must put these systems into place, which is a duty then in any case. So that comment in particular needs clarification from the submitters. And then the concept of an undesirable audit outcome, it appears that perhaps it's not widely understood, and if not, then what is a more acceptable and relevant term? Quite a few submitters did make suggestions. None of those suggestions are the same, though. So I think the AG's office needs to consider whether there is a more acceptable definition, or otherwise whether the definition needs to be beefed up so that there can be no room for argument as to what, in fact, an undesirable audit outcome means. Issue 8 is similar to Issue 6. It's the Municipal Finance Management Act in particular contains sufficient provisions and processes for debt recovery, and Kulesile did explain some of the added things that the MFMA has. Section 32.2 of the MFMA provides that a municipality must recover from the person liable for these losses. And our legal question here is, who is the municipality? Is it the AO or the Municipal Council, and where does the responsibility rest? Because the AG, of course, can't act if the accounting officer isn't responsible in law. Because you can't hold the accounting officer now to a standard that he needn't have applied in any case. So we would like for the municipalities to please explain to us practically how these recovery processes unfold. We have looked at quite a few of their policies. Some of the policies seem different from one municipality to the other, but perhaps they can better explain that. Dealing with that is also now this referrals for investigations to the disciplinary board, and what is the impact of this, if any. But again, my earlier comment stands. If indeed the accounting officer or the municipal council has gone to the extent of deferring things for investigation, then in my mind it would mean that they are indeed dealing with the issue of the loss, and then there is no need for the AG to step in. Then lastly, the MFMA provides for monies to be withheld from non-compliant municipalities who do not perform their functions. And the question is this not a deterrent enough? So why is government not withholding funds from these delinquent municipalities, as it were? But of course, that's outside of our scope, I think. The AG is not going to have any control over government and whether it decides to withhold funding. But in any event, Chair, I do have a constitutional concern about that, because the question then remains whether the withholding of funds is a means of punishing the innocent taxpayer who didn't cause the loss. I paid my water bill. I paid my electricity bill. The municipal manager has failed to pay ESCOM because there's looting or whatever the case may be. Why should I be held responsible in terms of a budget cut? Issue 9, are practical considerations relating to time and money spent, as well as accounting consequences for the identification of debtors. So the question was, who would pay the litigation costs? Because it's assumed that if you're acting against an AO that is currently still in office, the AO will simply claim that the department must pay the legal costs. And that's one that we can think about, because the certificate is going to be issued in the personal capacity rather than to the accounting office. It's not to a position, it's to a person. So I don't necessarily buy the argument that the department could validly then say they have a basis to pay those litigation costs. Then the AG will be bogged down in court battles that will detract from the AG's core function. The issue of there being hundreds and thousands of transactions that result in losses. So should there be some sort of a threshold to determine which ones warrant referral and recovery? So whether these are monetary thresholds and read together with some other thresholds, so if it's a repeat offender and, and that sort of thing we can think about. There were no ideas given in the submissions. It was rather just an open-ended comment. And then again, that debt collecting is a huge administrative burden and can it be done more effectively elsewhere. And then the appeal process, that instead of going directly to court on review, should there not be ADR procedures. But of course, the way we understand that the bill is going to work practically is that the AG will be in consultation with the AO for quite a long period of time. So if an AO is not happy, one would expect that communication would take place beforehand, and that the AG is going to apply his mind very carefully when issuing a certificate. But of course, it is a risk that is still there. And then, is the bill encouraging a duplication of responsibilities and therefore resources? So the point here is, why is the AO not doing what the AO is supposed to do? Why is the AG now having to step into the shoes of the AO, in a sense? And then lastly, will the AG need to register as a debt collector with a national credit regulator if it's actually collecting money? Another issue, this is issue 10 on page 14. The bill fails to provide for a proper audi alteram partem process, which is the principle of fairness, that you give the other party an opportunity to be heard. And in this regard, the term satisfactory in relation to the AG's personal satisfaction with the explanation is open to abuse. Submitters asked whether there should be an actual hearing. So are written submissions sufficient? Should the AG enjoy the sole power to determine whether to issue a certificate, or could there possibly be a board of some sort to ensure a collective decision? Would a referral committee consisting of external experts help to minimize the risk of subjectivity? But of course, in law, the decision that the AG makes would have to be a rational, reasonable decision, because that is precisely what would be challenged in the High Court in terms of the administrative law process. So the AG would certainly be short-sighted to issue these certificates without having properly applied his mind. And then, should there be criteria to determine what would be satisfactory? So should the bill perhaps say satisfactory should be where sufficient steps have been taken or not taken, and what are the nature of those steps? How much should the AO have done or not have done in order for the AG to issue the certificate? Issue 11, the power of referral and recovery will not be applicable to audits that the AG has opted out of. Now, members will recall that the AG does what it calls discretionary audits, where they can actually opt out of auditing, because the Constitution simply provides that they must audit national, local, and provincial. But the SOEs and so on, they can opt out of those. And the question is, if you allow them to opt out, are you then not inadvertently letting these other institutions off the hook? Because then you wouldn't practically issue a certificate in those cases. And my question there that I think we must think about is whether, so what happens in those cases is that the AG assists in choosing a private auditor to perform the AG's functions, where the AG's opted out. So can there be reliance on that private auditor's reports? Because if the AG is allowing a private auditor to step in the AG's shoes, then surely the expectation is that the private auditor must do a job as good, if not better, than what the AG himself would do. So is there an issue as to why we can't rely on those private auditor reports, so that the AG's hands are not tied and the AG can still act? And then the follow-up question is, but should the AG be allowed to opt out at all? Should we not say that the AG must do all of these auditing functions? But of course, that has practical implications in terms of cost and time and many other things, which I think their office is in a better place to explain and motivate as to why they opt out in the first place. Part B, with matters related to other aspects in the bill. This issue is raised very strongly by the public protector, who I understand is coming to present on it, and it's whether international audits should be allowed. because these institutions are not government funded, at least not funded by the South African government, and it won't contribute to strengthening democracy. So as I mentioned, subsection 4 in the Constitution does permit for additional powers and functions, but again, are these international audits reasonably linked to the auditing function of a supreme audit institution? We need to ask ourselves that question. Is there a possibility that the independence of the AG may be compromised because the permission of the oversight mechanism being this committee now must be obtained first? Because that's what we've said. They can't proceed with international audits until the committee gives its go-ahead. And is this allowing Parliament then to encroach on the functions of the AG? This is an issue that I raise myself, Chair, whether there is the possibility of international conflict or perceived conflict flowing from a refusal, so where the committee makes a decision that we shouldn't allow a particular international audit. Then, do international audits actually add value to the office of the AG? What is the purpose of the AG doing these audits? If so, how and what is the cost-benefit proposition? The AG will need to explain that. Things that I can think of offhand is that it's a means of skill development and transfer, possibly exposure to new technologies, audit systems, and so on. I've been told that at present it isn't actually a revenue stream and that it's been done on a cost recovery basis. So that's also something that we can think about. Then should there be additional criteria in the bill as to when an international audit can be done? And the suggestion here is that audits must not compromise the independence of the AG or detract from the core function of the AG, and that can indeed quite easily be built in. And then lastly, and Chair, this is my view, my thing that I've raised, is whether international audits have the effect of increasing the status and relevance of the AG, thereby instilling international confidence in the quality of our audit reports. Will it assist with investment and so on if people, international investors, know that these audit reports are reliable? But that's something that the AG can respond to. Issue 2, should the bill contain the maximum agreed amount or percentage in relation to audit fees that can be defrayed from the National Treasury vote? You'll be aware that we've amended Section 23. Currently, the National Treasury defrays 100% of the costs that an auditee can't pay, provided that the auditee is in financial difficulty. What the new amendment seeks to do is to put a cap on the amount that NT would pay, so either in the form of a percentage or an actual amount, and the parties are meant to reach agreement on what that amount must be. The question is, who will be liable now for the balance of fees that's currently carried by National Treasury? Because if they're not going to carry the 100%, and if they carry, let's say, 20%, who's liable for the 80%? Does it mean the AG is then forced to go back to court to try and recover from the auditee, and what the effect of that would be? The AG is under a constitutional obligation to audit certain auditees that are in financial distress. So the AG actually doesn't have a choice. The AG must audit. The difficulty the AG then faces is, how does the AG balance that constitutional obligation, which can't be changed in law, with the practical and financial implications of auditing an auditee then that doesn't pay? And what if no agreement is reached on this percentage or amount? Then there was a comment that the AG should not be allowed to draft his own regulations, as this would constitute a conflict of interest, and these would be the regulations in particular about the procedure for the recovery. And my question there is, how would this be different from line function ministers who have the power to draft regulations? Of course, in the case of the AG, you don't have a line function minister. So the AG, in fact, is the subject matter expert. So would the committee be best placed in drafting those regulations, or is the power correctly given to the AG? And I thought about whether the mischief in terms of the conflict can possibly be prevented if we put in certain additional criteria that say, for example, that publication is required or public participation process must be built in the drafting of the regulations, because that we could do quite easily. Whether the the means and the format for the committee to consider those regulations. Those are some of the things that we can add in. Issue four, should the AG be allowed to engage in limited assurance engagements and review engagements as opposed to reasonable assurance? So this is a change in Section 20. My understanding is that it's a slightly lower auditing standard. And the concern there is, are things going to now slip through the cracks because you're allowing the AG to audit at a little bit less of a 100% stringent standard as the AG does for other institutions? It's a policy issue. Perhaps submitters can explain to us whether it would have legal implications. The other thing that I would require clarity on is, does it meet audit obligations in terms of what an auditor must do? So is it an acceptable standard of audit, or does it fall short of what is an acceptable standard of audit if you do reasonable assurance? I don't know. I'm not familiar with the technicalities around this, but it can be explained to us. The question is, does it dilute the value of audits? And does it increase the risk of non-compliance and or the possibility of loss of public resources? So in other words, must we now rather keep it as it was, which means that the AG must do limited assurance engagements rather than, I mean, must do reasonable rather than limited assurance engagements. Issue five, the status of the certificate should be clear. Is it final or prima facie proof? The current drafting of the bill says it would serve as prima facie proof, but I think this is a valid concern that's been raised, that final would mean the AG can act on the certificate alone, and an objection can only happen via an administrative review process, where in a prima facie case, it's conceivable that the court would need to ascertain whether the debt in fact exists. So you take it outside of the administrative realm, and then you're asking the court then to determine the validity of the debt. Part C is matters not covered in the current bill. Quite a few submitters raised issues that don't appear in our draft bill at all, but they were of the view that these are important and the opportunity must be used to fix these as well. The first one is that the AG does not utilize the South African statements of generally recognized accounting practice, as do other constitutional institutions and the rest of government, as I understand. So in 2017, it used the International Financial Reporting Standards instead. The first thing to consider there is that the AG, in fact, is not a constitutional institution as provided for in Schedule 1 of the PFMA. So the provision on the generally recognized accounting practice, in fact, is not legally applicable in any case because they're not listed there. It's interesting that every other Chapter 9 institution is listed in Schedule 1, but the AG wasn't. So we assumed that the drafters there applied their mind, and there might have been a very valid reason for not including the AG. However, I think it is important that the committee considers the pros and cons associating with following another regime instead of following the one that the rest of government is following. Section 41(2) of the Act states that financial statements must be in accordance with GAAP or other international best practice approved by the oversight mechanism. So my question there is, why was this choice initially granted? Because we could have quite easily in this piece of legislation originally said this is a standard that they must follow and they are beholden to that standard. But it seems that we left an option open, and the committee can consider that option from time to time, but it's something that we can think about. I don't know what the technical reasons were for allowing the option in the first place, and maybe the AG can explain. Then there were some general issues. One of the submitters, and this is internal from the AG's office, submitted quite a long submission. It's submission 2 on the issue of access to information and how practically requests for access to information is dealt with. The committee will hear that submission, and then it can consider whether you want us to go back to the drawing board and adopt some of those proposals. They also mentioned, and again this was internal, that there should be consequences introduced for failure to comply with engagement letters. And engagement letters is the letter, it's the SLA in effect between the AG and the auditee. I think the complaint here is that auditees then don't submit information on time or they don't cooperate and so on. In any event, non-cooperation with the AG is a criminal offence, and the Constitution mandates that every person must cooperate with the AG. So it's not clear why the AG hasn't acted against those that failed to comply with the engagement letter in any case. Then there was a comment, and I think Corley mentioned it as well, that the AG should approve members of the audit committee in all organs of state. At the moment, that is dealt with in legislation. So your PFMA will say how the audit committees must be appointed. So, in fact, that would that amendment would have to be done in the financial management legislation. It can't be done here. But also the question I raise there, is it feasible and practical to expect the AG to appoint audit committees in every single government department and institution? I don't know if they have the capacity for that or not. Then another comment, the audit committee, so this is the audit committee within a department, should brief the AG on the application of the AG's recommendations. Again, I can't see what in law would prevent the AG from requesting those briefings in any case. I don't think it's something that we need to legislate and over-legislate on, but perhaps they can tell us practically whether they've ever done it, and if not, why not. There was another comment that recovery should be extended to recovery of funds paid in contravention of the requirements of the BBBE Act. In my view and my legal understanding, a contravention of that act would be deemed to be irregular in any case. So why refer to this particular act and then not refer to other pieces of legislation? Because then it may be seen later on that the intention was not to deal with losses or irregularities arising from other situations, for example, non-supply chain management ones. Because, of course, not all irregular or fruitless and wasteful necessarily stems from supply chain management functions. So we must make that distinction. Then we were asked to consider the power of the National Assembly to withdraw the certificate. What it currently provides is that where the AG issues a certificate, the AG himself won't be able to withdraw the certificate. The AG would have to request that the National Assembly withdraws the certificate. And the question there was, well, then what happens in an administrative review process? So assuming that the accounting officer has gone to court and the court says that the certificate isn't valid, does that mean we have to come back to the National Assembly and ask the National Assembly then to withdraw? And I don't think so. I think it's a jurisdictional, it's a fact. The court has made a decision. It would be exactly like legislation. When the court says Section 35 of the PFMA is unconstitutional, you don't pass it through Parliament again for Parliament to say that that section no longer stands in the statute book. And for me, that's fairly clear, but I suppose we could possibly clean up the drafting there. Then there was also comment that we must increase the penalties for the offence of interfering with the work of the AG. Currently, a person can receive a financial penalty or up to 12 months imprisonment, and the submitter there feels that it should be longer than 12 months imprisonment. And my practical question there is, has the AG ever acted on this particular provision in legislation? So has the AG ever laid criminal charges against somebody for obstructing the AG? Because if the AG hasn't done that, it would serve no purpose then to increase the 12 months if we're sitting at zero at the moment because these people are never acted against. 12 months seems to be consistent with similar legislation dealing with similar type offences, but of course the committee is at liberty to decide whether that should be increased or not. And then, so that's all from me, Chair, but my colleague, Daksha Kasson, who's been integral in assisting us in this bill, is the legislative drafting expert, and I'm just going to hand over to her for a minute or two just to speak particularly on drafting aspects that were raised in the submissions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see Fatima has used a full complement and gone over the 30 minutes allocated to us, but luckily I don't have much to say. I just want to mention that there were some submissions that did raise some drafting issues. We looked at those. Some of them largely relate to style. But when they do come and submit on those, I just want the committee to be mindful of the fact that this is an amendment bill. So an amendment bill usually takes its lead from the language and style used in the Principal Act. So we would have to look at those suggestions in light of that. But there were definitely certain useful comments made. For example, there were some submitters who commented on how certain definitions could be made stronger or more accurate. An example would be the definition of this act. We simply say this act includes regulations, and the suggestion is that refer to the section in the act in terms of which those regulations are made, and those are certainly things we can take on board. Some submitters also raised the issue that we have in certain sections, there's superfluous wording. For example, the term including but not limited to is used, and some feel that the words not limited to is superfluous, and those are certainly things we can take on board. And as Fatima mentioned, there are some submitters who said that the definitions are quite wide and also vague. For example, a lot of people had spoken about the definition of undesirable audit outcome. So that's definitely something we're going to have to look at in order to make that definition a lot clearer. Then the other point I want to just highlight to the committee is the fact that this is an amendment bill where the style of square brackets is used to indicate deletions from the bill. So in other words, words that are being taken out. And words that are underlined are words that are being put. But I think people are getting confused. So when we make a deletion, a submitter will comment as if that deletion is still in the bill, and then the whole comment sort of hinges on that. So those are just some of the points that I wanted to alert the committee to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes. Honourable members, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we're 7 of us. We've got just over 40 minutes. Can I give every member maximum of 5 minutes, maximum. If you don't want to say anything, you don't have to say anything. Maximum of 5 minutes just to exhale on everything. We've got quite a bit of stuff here, because that will then take us to 1:30. That was what we agreed upon. You don't have to do all that. Is there anybody that wants to have the first bite, or should I have the first bite so that you are able to, so that you are able to apply your mind? I know I'm ambushing you, but you'll have 5 minutes to deal with in you everything. You don't have to respond to it, because remember, the intention is for us to go and apply our minds when we get home. Any takers? 5 minutes? All right, sir, your 5 minutes starts now.
1 minute, Chair. I think the thank you for the presentations. The office of the AG and our legal advisor and the researchers have got the work cut out for them to start applying their minds, because they are the gurus, you know, especially the office of the AG. I mean, there are lots of comments. Secondly, I'm just trying to recall, you know, there's so many things, we've got so many irons in the fire, the chairman knows. Did we ever think about, or did the AG ever make a presentation about a unit within the office of the AG that will deal with the debt collection? Like with the IEC now, the political party funding bill, there was a submission from the IEC that there will be a unit, and they came up with, you know, I know you did tell us you need X million and what have you, but will this be a unit dedicated, so it's kind of quasi-independent from the functions of the Office of the Auditor General? So I'm just trying to think whether that was the case. And then on private auditors, I know there was a point raised. My view would be that these private auditors work under the auspices of the Office of the AG, and they monitored and evaluated, etc. And if they have to come up with an audit, it is like it being an audit of the office itself. So it's the audit of the office, not of the audit of the individual private auditor. So I'll stop there, Chair. Save you some time.
Thank you, sir. Anybody else? Tapem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm going to make a couple of points. Because I've resigned from Parliament, so I won't be around for the finalisation of this bill. Sorry. On point 23, just I think for clarity's sake, because I think people might get confused, there's a difference between generally accepted accounting practice and generally recognized accounting practice, okay? And what the Auditor General uses is generally accepted accounting practice. IFRS is generally accepted accounting practice now in South Africa, effectively. So that's the reason why the Auditor General uses that. So I think that's a mission you can just ignore.
On the multiple, on the constitutional issue, I agree. I think that subsection 4 covers this more than more than it needs to. I would hesitate to go to the argument what other auditors do, because auditors don't do what this is saying. But I think you should rely on what internationally other supreme audit bodies do. That would be a good standard. But I think, and I'm not sure where the DA's position is going to be on this bill, because I've heard a lot of people, even in Treasury, not in the official sides of Treasury now, that are very unhappy about this extra power being given to the AG's office. So it is quite serious. And the referral to the state attorney is interesting. I haven't thought about it. We should maybe consider that more, that maybe the AG should just issue the certificate to the state attorney, and then the state attorney or some other body theoretically has the power to go in and collect the money. It's an idea, because the way I'm seeing it, the AG is doing it because there's nobody else doing it. If the accounting office is not doing it, who does it? The hawks aren't going to do it because it's not their role to do it. So there's nobody else, and that's why by default we put in it here. But maybe we should consider whether maybe the state attorney's office shouldn't have a division. But I mean, that's probably, that department's under so much strain at the moment. Okay. And then also the multiple roles that you're alleged to, they are saying, Irma's my big friend, eh? So I don't listen too much what they say sometimes. because other auditors don't do it. Doesn't mean it can't. So, for instance, I'm an auditor, but I also issue summonses in the High Court. In terms of another act, I'm an attorney. So there's nothing stopping the AG from having an audit role and another role of debt collection for the state, theoretically, I'm saying. It's because it's a separate act empowering them to do so. I'm sure they use internal audit. It's not even a question. They'll confirm that. All municipalities have to act to the county officers. So if the municipal council takes a decision, the county officer has to execute it, you know. But they can never go and issue a summons in their personal capacity. It's always going to, the council could never do it. So it is correct that the county officer must be responsible for that money. I think on the matter of cost orders, the High Court is generally given an order as they like. Maybe we should just refer that to the courts in the state and amend the summoning to the word in that. The court will then decide who will pay the legal fees in civil proceedings. Also, interestingly enough, yeah, I thought for a while, because if the order, the AG issues the certificate and you refuse to pay it, this AG has got to go to court, effectively. And then I thought, well, potentially the person would then be able to dispute it in any event. Because if the AG didn't do it, for instance, and the county officer did it, you would go to court to recover that money. And that it would be at that point where in court you could argue whether the debt was due or unpayable or not. But what we have done here is by saying that certificate is not refutable, the only way to refute the certificate is to go to the High Court on the Promotion of Justice Act. Maybe allow the person, if you're in civil proceedings, to argue the legitimacy of the certificate there, then it might alleviate the first concern about forcing somebody to have to go to court to set aside it. You know, because at the moment, the way it's read, it's you go to court to recover the money, but you can't in that point argue that the debt is an owing. Okay, you've got to then go and bring another court application. So why take that power away from a court? They're both high courts. Maybe just allow the High Court also to consider whether the Promotion of Justice, administrative law has been applied correctly. Potentially consider that, and then that's it. The opt-out thing, I wanted to say something about opt-out. They've got to be allowed to opt-out. I mean, there's purely a matter of capacity and also skills. Auditors need to have that power to do it and to subcontract. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me add my 5 cents worth. We're doing well, honourable members. On your point one, ma'am, what are you saying is, I mean, people are questioning the Auditor General's powers, roles, or whatever for referral. My understanding was the AG will refer after he has done his audit and he picks up unauthorized, fruitless, or wasteful expenditure. In other words, there's prima facie evidence. And I don't understand why people have a problem if the Auditor General says, he has prima facie evidence, I don't have the power, Mr. Hawks, go and do the work. or he's not duplicating. What he is saying is, I've picked it up. I don't have the ability to do this thing because I'm not an engineer or the Hawks. I'm giving it to the Hawks, or I'm giving it to... So whoever comes to that argument will have to explain why they think that it's a problem. But I thought the referral was in order, personally. And, of course, the independence of the AG, should he report to Treasury or not, I think we must look at it. I do think that his independence must be guarded at all costs. Does putting the money in the revenue fund make him report to Treasury? Then maybe your argument of reporting to us must be something that we should look at more closely. But we'll have time to argue that later on. Of course, like I said, the whole referral issue, generally, I'm saying AG's department will come and talk. My understanding is that you are not going to recreate the wheel. You do your audit, there is facts or prima facie, you take it to whoever to do the necessary work. You're not going to create another arm to go and do the investigations because you don't have the capacity to do that. That's what I thought it was. And certainly on the issues around why do we deal with the accounting authority and not officials. I mean, the Act is very clear. You deal with the accounting authority in all instances. In fact, the PFMA says managers must manage. Now, if we go and we say it can't be the accounting officer, it must be the guy at the bottom, we're in effect trying to manage. We will say to the accounting officer, you must manage. If it is a supply chain management person, it's his responsibility. So I don't think we're doing anything wrong by the buck stops with the accounting authority. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But those that say, why are we not going to the official, we're covering it up, is wrong. And then, of course, around the regulations, I agree that we can't put everything in here. There must be regulations that deal with the nitty-gritty. I think I agree. And, of course, everybody's going to argue that it's not expanded enough, but we'll explain that it's there. And I also agree that the regulations can't be done other than by the AG. It can be done by the AG and brought to us for ratification. So I think that's where it should be done. And of course, yeah, we're going to have to maybe, honourable members, go and try and improve our articulation of what mischief is it that we're trying to fix up here. Because that seems to be the question that you're raising. Why give the AG more power? So I think we must go and craft what is the mischief that we're trying to fix here and continue to spread that message. Because I think we've adopted as a committee the fact that it must be strengthened. So we must all be able to go and articulate what is the mischief that we're trying to fix up here. I agree also that we must clarify what is this thing that we call undesirable. Exactly what does it mean? What is this thing undesirable? Methods of emphasis, reasons for qualifications. Maybe we should do that around that. And then of course the issue that I raised. And I suspected that it would come from practitioners at local government level. Why are you doing this? Because MFMA gives it to these people to do. Maybe we're going to have that discussion. It does give it to them to do. The question is, what mischief are we trying to fix up? There's no doubt that quite a sizable amount of the financial maladministration happens at local government level. Let's just be very clear about that. And if it's happening there, then they must come and explain what is it that they're doing, if they think that what we're doing is a duplication or is superfluous. And those are the questions. Why must we do this? The MFMA already covers that, and so does the PFMA cover that. So it's the whole question around the mischief that we need to fix up, honorable members. Around issue number 9, litigation, who's going to pay? Of course, we would have to look at that, who's going to pay around litigation. And take it from there. But I also know, and Singh would know, and others would know, that there's going to be more and more focus on legal costs from departments. Currently, departments just go to court because they're not interested in legal costs. We'll have to encourage our comrades and friends in other portfolio committees to say, but you need to look at legal costs. Departments can't just go and litigate for litigating's sake because it's not their money. But it's a reality that we'd have to work on. Yeah,
the whole issue around the decision to make a certificate and otherwise, again, it's the independence of the Auditor General. I think that if he's got sufficient information, he should do the certificate. The people are asking, does he have the power? Should there be a review? Well, I think at the end of the day, everybody has review. I'm saying all Chapter 9 institutions can be put on review if they wanted to, isn't it? So if you think the AG is overstepping his mark, and it's not inconceivable that he would overstep his mark, but there are mechanisms to deal with that. I think that's how we should argue that at going forward. And of course, Honorable Singh spoke about people being worried that private auditors. Well, private auditors are subcontractors to the AG, and the AG can never outsource his accountability. If the subcontractor messes up, we must deal with the AG. So there shouldn't be any fight around those matters. The whole issue around does the AG need to do, should we give him the power to do international work? Well, the AG is asked by the United Nations to do some work for him. For them. We're part of the United Nations. Should we be saying to the AG he shouldn't do that? I think even your friends, the Herba, themselves rely on international standards. So I don't think there's any conflict. I don't think there's any diluting of the Constitution when he or she... We should be able to influence. All of us play in the international arena because if our ideas are correct, we must influence the whole world. As long as it doesn't weaken his responsibility here. But I don't think there's any constitutional challenge about the AG helping the rest of the world where it's necessary. In fact, all these things called APEC and whatever they have are international bodies that the AG chairs. Now, the people that raise this probably don't know that, and we need to raise it to them. Yeah, I know who's raised it. I'm just raising it. But these are practices. So I don't have a problem with the constitutionality or otherwise of international work. I certainly don't have a problem with that. I think that's how, of course, you spoke about GRAP and all those type of things. I think I'm happy with that. And of course, the drafting is drafting. I mean, we're always going to fix it up, or we always need there's room to strengthen, but that's going to come later on. So those are the issues that I wanted to raise, Honourable Members. And really, like I said, the intention was for us to just psych ourselves up for these hearings on Tuesday. None of these are binding, so people that are hearing us might be getting our initial bite. We will hear what the presenters put to us. We will argue their case. We'll come back, and we will strengthen the current bill on the basis of the input and present another one. So people should be prepared to debate and argue and to be convinced and for us to be convinced. So nobody should think that it's a fait accompli. Ours are just our initial views, and we are open to be convinced, as everybody else should be open to be convinced. And I'm saying this not to us here, but I'm saying it to those that are going to participate. So by no means are we closed to any views. These were just our initial shots and in preparation for meaningful dialogue with those that submitted. Honorable Bengu.
Thanks, Chair. But to me, I was just having a question on what the presenter has said, referring to the Inkande judgment on the public protector. As we have said earlier on, that the AG is one of the Chapter 9 institutions. That means his or her decision are binding. So what I wanted to know is, what does it mean that the NA should be the one who can consider in its power to withdraw the certificate?
Honorable Chopham will have one more bite, and then you'll have 5 minutes to, if you need to, comment on all the views that have been given. Honorable Chopham.
Very quick, we must consider prescription, because you said there's no timeline. I think the normal common law prescription would then kick in, so we might want to extend prescription. That's quite a big issue that hasn't been, that would be deep public consultation. What Honourable Singh said earlier about the retainer, I think
The Auditor General works on a cost recovery basis, etc. So there's nothing in this act about it. So maybe we do want to put in a debt recovery percentage fee or something, allow it to can be charged to offset the cost if they do it. And very importantly about the mischief, and this is where I actually want us to look carefully. If you look at the introduction to the bill, it says, yeah, amongst others, against the responsible persons, to recover the money from responsible persons. If you look in the actual act, it talks about the accounting officer being the responsible accounting officer. So my understanding is the intention is to only act against an accounting officer who fails to recover the money from the officials, employees, or himself, theoretically, because he's protecting somebody. And if that is the case, then this is a very should only happen in extremely limited circumstances. It's really meant to be like should never happen, right? But if we want to give it further to give him the power to actually go against the actual individual employee, it would be easy for us to insert the word or other person responsible for the loss or something like that. So it depends on what the mischief is that we're trying to do. Is it only to go after the accounting officer or to go after the money that hasn't been recovered by an accounting officer? So the incentive being the way it's worded at the moment is you do your job or we can ask you for the money that you should have asked somebody else for. Okay, if that's it, then the wording is perfect.
Any last bite from members before I hand over to legal? No, you've got 5 minutes to make any comments that you'd want to make, and the intention is to sharpen us up. Fatima and your team.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in relation to the Nkandla judgment, I just want to draw the committee's attention to the fact that Section 182 that establishes the public protector is a little bit distinguishable from the section that establishes the Auditor General, insofar as in the case of the public protector, the Constitution specifically says that the public protector has remedial powers. And what was tested in court were whether those remedial powers were binding or not. Similarly, the section that deals with the Human Rights Commission says that the Human Rights Commission may take steps for appropriate redress. Now, those were not included in the section that deals with the AG. The constitutional question that then arises is whether by us now giving the AG these remedial powers, because in effect this is what it is, it's a remedial power now to recover, whether that would constitute an extension of the constitutional mandate or not. I think it's a very fine line. From my current research, I'm still feeling comfortable that it's within the constitutional mandate. I would need to be convinced during the submissions why our initial take is incorrect. On the issue of the withdrawal of the certificate, in law, when the AG at least makes the decision to issue the certificate, the AG would be functus officio. He's now taking that as a final decision. He's not going to review his own decision at that point. A review of the decision would need to go to the High Court. But I think the Honourable Member raises an important point. What was the purpose of building in the provision that the NA can withdraw the certificate? And what would be the circumstances where the NA would withdraw a certificate? And are we perhaps making something which should be an administrative task political in a sense? And is there that risk that the AG issues and what happens is that the NA simply withdraws without valid reasons? So I definitely think that's something that we must consider if that is what the argument is. When it was drafted, our understanding at that point would be if there was new evidence perhaps that came to light or something that would change the position. You wouldn't leave it in the AG's hands himself to take the decision because you also don't want the AG to be influenced or threatened by people. So in that case, after the AG issues a certificate and somebody wants to threaten or influence the AG in withdrawing it, the AG can simply say, well, I don't have that power in law to withdraw. You would need to go to the High Court or you would need to go to Parliament to do it. But certainly we can think about it a little bit more. Thank you, Chair.
Absolute last, Mr. Topham, and then we will try and wrap up.
Sorry, I just want to clarify. The way it's worded at the moment, the NA can't withdraw a certificate. The NA can only condone the withdrawing by the AG. The only person that can force the AG to withdraw the certificate is the High Court. So that's from my understanding here.
All right. Honourable members, I'm assuming that you are now a bit more confident in facing whatever we might face on Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, and Friday at 9 o'clock. So that's what we will do. After having received those submissions, I'm trying to look at our program. What do we do after that, Cindy? It's the first one. So we'll receive those submissions, and from there, we do the drafting. We go to Treasury. The AG responds. Committee will sit and look at all those things, public, AG, Treasury, and then we'll consider amendments if we think they are necessary. Put pen to paper in terms of those amendments and take it to the House. Yes?
Yeah.
And then take it to the House for the House to condone or otherwise. That's really the roadmap going forward, Honourable Members. So it is going to be tight because you recall that it was you that took the decision that we must do this by the end of March. So it's literally every Friday, I think, that we meet and other days. Tuesday, Wednesdays and Fridays, wherever it is, but we've got a deadline of the 29th. And I know it's going to be tough because there are many other deadlines that we need to meet. Thank you very much to our colleagues from Legal and to Goli. The Auditor General, at some point, you'd have to respond to us. You've got a sense and flavor of what the members and also South Africans are saying. Cindy, you're not going to forget to give in a WhatsApp form, the physical address to members for Tuesday, Honourable Members, and those that are leaving from here, leave from here at 9 o'clock, at 8.30 from Port Says, to go to the outside venue. And I'm assuming Legal will be there. I'm assuming AG, you'll have some representatives there. And, of course, our friends in the media, thank you very much, and you're also more than welcome. It is at the St. George's, what's the name of the hotel? The Fountains Hotel. Fountains Hotel. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. This meeting is adjourned.